Today is Thursday, August 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Russian opposition activist Alexei Navalny is in the hospital.
He was on a tour in Siberia. He was on his way home on a flight to Moscow when he fell ill aboard the flight.
Plus, after Kamala Harris accepted the U.S. Democratic Party's nomination for vice president.
The road ahead is not easy, but I pledge to you that we will act boldly.
What does Joe Biden need to do between now and the election? We'll have these stories and more next. Russian opposition politician Alexei Navalny is in a coma and on a ventilator in a hospital intensive care unit in Siberia after falling ill from suspected poisoning during a flight. He's helped release high-impact investigations into what he's described as extreme official corruption and has served several stints in jail for organizing anti-Kremlin protests. Charles Maines is in Moscow and explains what we know about the circumstances surrounding Navalny's hospitalization.
Well, so Alexei Navalny, he's the Russian opposition leader. He was on a tour in Siberia. He was on his way home on a flight from the city of Tomsk in Siberia to Moscow when he fell ill aboard the flight. He actually collapsed inside the laboratory. We have a witness video from the plane where you can hear Mr. Navalny screaming in pain from the laboratory. The plane then made an emergency landing in the city of Omsk, where he's now in hospital. Doctors have put him into an induced coma and connected him to a respirator. His spokeswoman, Kira Yarmish, says that it was a deliberate poisoning. Mr. Navalny had had some tea in the morning. In fact, there's pictures of him sitting in the airport having his tea. And, of course, from the airlines, we've also heard that they served him no food or drink while he was aboard the flight. So that's their theory for now.
Has there been any official response from the Russian government about the accusation?
No official response from the Russian government yet. I suspect we may hear some comment from the Kremlin spokesman when he gives his sort of daily talk with journalists here in Moscow. We know that there are plenty of police on the scene, presumably to do an investigation. We have also heard from the deputy head doctor of the hospital, who said that Navalny's condition had stabilized but was still serious. He said that doctors weren't simply doing everything possible. They were trying to save his life, working to save his life.
Have the physicians or the hospital commented on the allegation of poisoning?
They have not, and we've gotten some conflicting signs from that. He was checked in under suspicion of poisoning, but the presence of police, at least according to Mr. Navalny's associates, they think that that's led them to kind of squash that theory, at least initially, until some kind of messaging can be come out in terms of a theory of what's behind this. But we have to acknowledge the reality of a kind of a grim history of poisoning of government opponents in Russia.
There was also the poisoning of Sergei Skripal and his daughter in Britain.
Absolutely, absolutely. So there's a pattern here, and part of the debate that centers in Moscow and is whether this is the doing of the government or if it's independent actors.
Charles Maines reports from Moscow, Russia. Senator Kamala Harris formally accepted the Democratic Party's nomination as its vice presidential candidate Wednesday night.
So make no mistake, the road ahead is not easy. We may stumble. We may fall short. But I pledge to you that we will act boldly and deal with our challenges honestly.
The evening was a parade of speeches by prominent Democrats, including former President Barack Obama.
I never expected that my successor would embrace my vision or continue my policies. I did hope, for the sake of our country, that Donald Trump might show some interest in taking the job seriously.
Speaking to reporters, President Trump said the only reason that he was in the White House was because of President Obama and former Vice President Joe Biden.
The reason I'm here is because of President Obama and Joe Biden, because if they did a good job, I wouldn't be here.
Former Vice President Joe Biden takes the virtual stage this evening as the Democrats round out their virtual national convention. But how effective has it been in getting their message across to prospective voters? For that, I spoke to a political science professor, Craig Albert, who teaches at Augusta University, and I asked him to grade how the Democrats are doing.
You know, I would give it a B minus right now, and one big reason for that is because it seems to be following the same protocol or the same narrative as the 2016 message, which was not Trump or anti-Trump. So to me, when I'm watching, there's a consistent theme or unified message of we just need to get rid of Trump however we need to. They lay out detail with decoded eloquence why that is, and their narrative and the messaging on that provides examples, goes into specificity, which is great. So as a professor, I'd rank them highly for that. The problem is it's unclear as to what their main policy changes will be, how they will go about actually unifying the country, which is one of their main messages, is unifying after the presidency of Donald Trump. But how are they going to do that? What are these new policies? They got a little more into this in night three with specific policy prescriptions, but I'm not sure if they've done a good job over the whole convention with detailing that specific policy. And so far, the main message seems to be anti-Trump. And if you're talking about the independent voter or perhaps the working voter that voted for Trump instead of Hillary Clinton in 2016, I'm not sure more of an anti-Trump message is going to motivate them to go vote.
Well, you bring up a few interesting points there, because when we spoke last week, you know, you brought the point that, you know, majority of voters have already decided who they're going to vote on well before these conventions, the Democratic convention this week, the Republican next week. And, you know, the message is not Trump from the Democrats. So does even anything they really say have an impact on those few who are undecided? I mean, is this the venue that they need to be doing that in?
That's a great point. And it's not exactly clear who's watching this either. So we know televised viewership is down pretty significantly from 2016. We don't have an understanding of the online audience yet, though the DNC has announced that about an additional 10 million people are viewing from the internet. But who are these individuals? My first assumption is that these are diehard base supporters of the Democrats that are watching this. They're tuning in because it's exciting to them, it's enthusiastic to them, and it's serving their base. I'm not sure if it's reaching that independent voter or the moderately conservative reporter who voted for Trump kind of as a last resort in 2016. So it's unclear whether this is the place where that message should be coming across. The problem with this, Steve, is that if this isn't the place, where is the place? When is the campaign, the narrative, or the messaging or advertising for Joe Biden really going to hit the policies that are going to focus upon the independent voter or the reluctant Trump voter? I still maintain that this election hinges on the 2016 reluctant Trump voter. Whoever gets that voter on their side is going to win this election.
All right, one last question, and really quick. What does Joe Biden need to do between now and the election to best make his case?
He needs to have clear policy statements. He needs to continue to be eloquent the way he is in delivering these messages, but he needs to make sure that the policy objectives are clear and how those policies differ from Trump. We all know what Trump's personality is, so Biden continuing to focus on that, I don't think is going to help the independent voter. They want to know concrete, clear policy directives, and that's what I think Joe Biden should focus upon.
Craig Albert is a political science professor at Augusta University in the southern state of Georgia. President Trump is also praising backers of a pro-Trump conspiracy theory, and AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani has that story.
QAnon is a baseless theory centering on an alleged anonymous high-ranking government official who shares information about an anti-Trump deep state, often tied to Satanism and child sex trafficking.
I don't know much about the movement other than I understand they like me very much. Which I appreciate.
An FBI bulletin last May specifically mentioned QAnon in saying conspiracy theory-driven extremists are a domestic terror threat.
I've heard these are people that love our country.
And they were quick to celebrate on social media, with many saying the president validated their views. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Former White House advisor Steve Bannon was arrested Thursday on charges that he, as well as three others, ripped off donors in an online fundraising scheme called We Build the Wall. Federal prosecutors allege that Bannon and the three others orchestrated a scheme to defraud hundreds of thousands of donors with an online campaign that raised more than $25 million to build part of the wall along the southern border of the United States. Bannon has been a backer of U.S. President Donald Trump, who campaigned on a premise to build a wall along the U.S. border with Mexico to halt illegal immigration. A spokeswoman for Bannon did not immediately respond to requests from the Associated Press for comment. This is a developing story, and VOA will have additional coverage on our website, voanews.com. You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Steve Miller. Malian President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita's resignation followed weeks of large anti-government demonstrations in the capital of Bamako. Earlier today, I spoke to Daniel Izenga, a research fellow at the African Center for Strategic Studies here in Washington, to get an idea of what's next for the country and the region.
There was a group of five military officers who announced the establishment of the Committee for the Salvation of the People, or the CNSP, which is the political organization of the military junta, which took power after President Keita's resignation. That group of five officers is composed of mostly higher-level officers, four colonels and a colonel major. But I guess the takeaway there is that this is not what's sometimes referred to as a junior officer's coup or a junior officer's military intervention, because these are relatively high-ranking soldiers.
Now, the United States State Department has condemned the coup, but I wanted to get your take on this. You know, based on what you know about these higher-level officers, going forward, do you anticipate that they may regret forcing Keita out and having this transitional government?
It's very difficult to say, but it's certainly problematic for Mali. Mali has been central to the ongoing crisis in the Sahel, the broader region. And that crisis has only gotten worse in recent years, and it's been doing so rapidly. Violence has been increasing, nearly doubling every year since 2015. Or to put that differently, by some counts, the number of fatalities as a result of militant Islamist violence in the Sahel is already this year equal to roughly equal to the number of recorded fatalities last year. And because Mali is sort of in the middle of the region, and many of the militant Islamist groups operating in the region and responsible for that violence are based in Mali, any kind of political instability just injects further uncertainty to that crisis.
Well, that's what I want to touch base on. You know, with the military now engaged in some sort of governance here with the replacements of Keita, do you think these militant groups will take advantage of the political instability, at least in the short term, and increase their attacks in the region?
I think that there's a fairly good chance that that's going to happen. We've certainly witnessed that in the past when there has been political instability in the various countries that comprise the Sahel, speaking mostly of Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger, we've seen that militant Islamist groups have shifted their operations and focus where there is, where they can take an advantage, where they're able to gain an advantage against an armed forces, a regional armed forces that is not as prepared, or where there isn't as much regional coordination going on. And with the military taking power in Bamako, it undoubtedly just makes the whole armed forces apparatus in Mali more preoccupied with what's happening in Bamako as opposed to their regional commitment to the partner security forces.
What kind of impact will this have on the region?
The regional bloc ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States, had tried to engage to find a negotiated solution between the Malian government and this protest movement. And I don't think that the military intervention is really a step forward, but I also find that it's going to be really difficult to figure out what the next steps are.
That was Daniel Izanga at the African Center of Strategic Studies. India counted another record number of new coronavirus infections today as it ramped up testing to more than 900,000 every day. The 69,652 new cases pushed India's total past 2.8 million. India has the third most cases in the world, only behind the United States and Brazil, and has the fourth highest number of deaths behind the United States, Brazil, and Mexico. Globally, there are nearly 22.5 million confirmed cases, 14.3 million recoveries, and 788,000 deaths, according to Johns Hopkins University here in the United States. Elsewhere, international visitors to Australia may be required to have a vaccination against COVID-19 under government plans. Canberra says it has secured the rights to the Oxford University vaccine in Britain, which is thought to be one of the frontrunners in the global race to find an effective vaccine. Phil Mercer has those details.
The Oxford University study is among a crowded international field of teams racing to develop a safe and effective coronavirus vaccine. Usually scientific work of this complexity would take years, but research is being fast-tracked at unprecedented speed. Australia has signed a deal with British drug maker AstraZeneca to produce and distribute the Oxford vaccine if it works. All Australians would be offered doses, but a medical panel would determine a priority list of recipients, including health workers and the elderly. Prime Minister Scott Morrison.
We've signed a letter of intent with AstraZeneca, which will enable Australia to access, should it be successful, the vaccine for COVID-19 here in Australia, manufactured here in Australia, distributed free to 25 million Australians in the event that those trials prove successful.
Morrison backtracked after earlier suggesting vaccinations against the coronavirus could become mandatory for Australian citizens. However, government officials have said the vaccine could be compulsory for anyone travelling to Australia, if that was the advice from medical experts. Australia's borders are currently closed to foreign nationals. Paul Kelly, the nation's chief medical officer, believes uptake of any vaccine in Australia would be high.
The first will be a voluntary call for people, and I'm sure there will be long queues, socially distanced, of course, for this vaccine. It will be incredibly welcomed by many. It will be the absolute ticket to get back to some sort of normal society and the things that we all love and enjoy.
The aim is for 95% of the population to be inoculated, although experts doubt that figure could be achieved because of concerns in Australia about any new coronavirus drug and the speed at which it's been developed. Australia was also looking to sign deals with other vaccine developers. Human trials on a potential treatment have started at the University of Queensland. Experts there believe a vaccine will be available for emergency use by the middle of 2021. Officials in Canberra have said they were in discussions with Australia's neighbours, including Indonesia, Papua New Guinea and Fiji, about supplying a vaccine. Australia has recorded about 450 coronavirus deaths, most from an outbreak in the state of Victoria. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
An Israeli settler leader is angry with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Reuters' Adam Reed explains.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has angered settlers on the disputed West Bank who have accused him of, quote, defrauding them. Netanyahu agreed in principle to shelve controversial plans to annex the territory as part of last week's normalization deal with the United Arab Emirates. Settlers accused Netanyahu of repeatedly floating the idea of annexation, only to cave in to international pressure and walk back on his promises. David Eliani leads the Yesha Council, the settlers' main umbrella organization.
He deceived us. He deceived the residents of the Jordan Valley. He defrauded us, duped us. He made us think he was about to apply sovereignty, while he never really meant to.
He also accused the Prime Minister of lacking the courage to go through with the plans. Around 450,000 Israeli settlers now live among 3 million Palestinians in the West Bank, with a further 200,000 settlers in East Jerusalem. During recent elections, Netanyahu promised to apply Israeli sovereignty to areas of the West Bank, including Jewish settlements, but said he was waiting for the go-ahead from Washington to proceed. When President Trump announced the UAE deal, he said annexation was now off the table. Polls have shown wide support throughout Israel for the UAE deal, a view backed by some living in the settlement. Most countries view the settlement as illegal, a view that Israel and the United States dispute.
That was Reuters reporter Adam Reed. Thai police have arrested 9 pro-democracy activists in a crackdown on protests that have emerged as the most serious threat to the government of Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha. The activists have called on the former army general and his administration to resign, accusing them of incompetence and corruption. Prayut and the military seized power in a 2014 coup and then retained it in a 2019 election, widely seen as being rigged. Taiwan has accused China of carrying out cyber attacks. Reuters' Edward Buran has more.
Taiwan said on Wednesday that hacking groups linked to the Chinese government had attacked at least 10 government agencies and thousands of email accounts of government officials to steal important data. Taiwan has been urging its people to be alert for what officials call omnipresent infiltration from China. That includes Beijing-backed media campaigns and cyber attacks against the island that China considers its territory. Liu Chai-zung from Taiwan's Investigation Bureau said some of the IP addresses used are those connected to mainland hacking groups, and that they were aiming to acquire important government documents and data. Liu's office said it had not been able to identify what data was stolen as the hackers concealed their tracks.
Edward Buran reports for Reuters News. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for joining us. Be sure to stay up to date with news and world events by visiting our website. Just point your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States remains committed to holding the Syrian regime of President Bashar al-Assad accountable for its innumerable atrocities against the Syrian people, some of which rise to the level of war crimes and crimes against humanity. That's why the Departments of State and Treasury released 14 new designations under the Caesar Syrian Civilian Protection Act and other authorities on July 29th. The latest tranche of designations was named the Hama and Marat al-Numan sanctions in honor of the victims of two of the Assad regime's most notorious atrocities. 9 years ago, Assad's troops carried out a brutal siege of the city of Hama, killing scores of peaceful protesters in a shocking sign of what was to come. 1 year ago, the Assad regime and its allies bombed a busy marketplace in Marat al-Numan, killing 42 innocent Syrians during Ramadan, right before families sat for iftar. The Assad regime's military has killed hundreds of thousands of civilians, detained and tortured peaceful protesters, and destroyed schools, hospitals, and markets without regard for human life. U.S. authorities designated Zuhair Tawfiq al-Assad and the 1st Division of the Syrian Arab Army, in addition to Zuhair Tawfiq al-Assad's adult son, Karam al-Assad, pursuant to Executive Order 13894. The U.S. also designated Bashar al-Assad's adult son, Hafiz al-Assad, pursuant to Executive Order 13894. The United States will continue to hold Bashar al-Assad and his regime accountable for their atrocities, while keeping the memory of their victims alive. It is time for Assad's needless, brutal war to end. A political solution under UN Security Council Resolution 2254 is the only credible path to peace for the Syrian people. The Caesar Act and other U.S. Syria sanctions authorities are not intended to harm the Syrian people and do not target humanitarian assistance or hinder stabilization activities in northeast Syria. The United States will continue its humanitarian assistance even in areas under the Assad regime's control. The United States has contributed more than $11.3 billion in humanitarian assistance since the start of the conflict and will continue to do so. There must be accountability and justice for the victims of Hamas, Marat al-Nouman, and of the Assad regime's other war crimes and crimes against humanity. The Assad regime and those who support it have a simple choice. Take irreversible steps toward a lasting political solution to end the Syrian conflict in a manner that respects the rights and dignity of the Syrian people, or face new, crippling sanctions.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.